This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the part of the program which we call the Big Picture, where we attempt to unravel the totally inscrutable so that you can understand what it is you are hearing. And this week, the Fed met, no surprise, they left interest rates unchanged. But then the press conference after clarified rather importantly the Fed's intentions on a more long-term basis. They plan to go forward raising interest rates and beginning another form of tightening of the balance sheet. So what we're going to do here on the first part of the Big Picture today is to get into the nuances of what was said and the implications for the financial markets and for the economy. So, Jim, here we have. We're in a situation right now. We have virtually no inflation. Economic growth is anemic. And yet here they are, rate raising again. Why are they doing that?
You know, I think, John, this has to be put into context because a lot of people have asked that. Gee, they haven't hit their 2% inflation target. We haven't had 3, 4, or 5% economic growth as the Fed was projecting early on in this recovery. There are several reasons, and the primary one is they would like to normalize interest rates and reload the chambers for the next financial crisis and the next economic downturn, because they know eventually we're going to have another recession, we will have another bear market, we will have another financial crisis. And so what are they going to do when the next crisis arrives if they're still at very, very low interest rates, which I still think they're going to end up in the very end not getting to where they want to be? What do they do? In other words, they're trying to reload the chambers with ammunition so they have something to do to respond if the economy goes into a recession. And it's kind of like, gosh, we've played that clip, John. Gosh, it was taken from The Office. It's like, I like to do this so I can lower my cholesterol. Why are you doing this to raise your cholesterol? Well, so I can lower it. Well, that's what they're doing. They are trying to raise rates so they'll have the ammunition to respond. And they also believe, I think at this point, that the economy is on stronger footing, so they feel they have the room to raise and normalize monetary policy. Now, remember, this all began in 2013. Here we are 4 years later, and all they've done is they've raised interest rates four times. So it's taken them 3 years to raise interest rates four times. So it just goes to show you how fragile this economy is, and they really haven't had the wherewithal, the means. We don't have an overheating economy as we did during the leading up to the housing crisis when we had 4 and 5% inflation rates. The economy was growing over 3%, and we had inflation. Of course, we also had oil prices going from $50 to $150. None of that exists today, but they do know sooner or later we will be in another crisis.
They did mention that they thought third quarter economic growth would be impacted by weather events.
In the third quarter, however, economic growth will be held down by the severe disruptions caused by hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. As activity resumes and rebuilding gets underway, growth likely will bounce back. Based on past experience, these effects are unlikely to materially alter the course of the national economy beyond the next couple of quarters.
Okay, so that's something that we've mentioned here, too, and that is that Janet Yellen mentioned that the economic numbers will be skewed as a result of the three hurricanes that we've had come back-to-back affecting U.S. territory. But overall, aside from that, which is an anomaly in the whole thing, what was your overall impression of the Fed's meeting?
You know, I think if you were to assess the meeting, there were three key takeaways that are going to be real important going forward. The first one is the December rate hikes remain on the table. And it's amazing because we talked about, if you take the last 3 weeks, John, 3 weeks ago, the probability of a Fed rate hike in December stood below 30%. It got down to 28%. Then we got an inflation number last week, and it jumped to 50%. And then as a result of the FOMC meeting, the Fed futures market is now pricing in over a 70% chance of a rate hike coming in December. So this will be the first year the Fed was able to effectively raise the Fed funds rates three times. And remember, the first 2 years of tightening, they only did it once a year. They did it in December of 2015. They did it in December of 2016. This year, if they manage to raise rates in December, which is looking more likely given what the futures market is pricing in right now, they will raise rates three times. So the first one, or the first takeaway, is a high probability of another rate hike coming in December. The second one is they plan to initiate their long telegraphed plan to shrink their balance sheet. Now remember, in December of 2016 was the first time they broached the subject. Oh, by the way, we're going to start reducing our balance sheet. So they've been telling us they're going to do this at almost every single FOMC meeting and press conference. So that begins October 1st and begins next month. The third takeaway is they lowered their long-term goal of rate normalization from a 3% Fed funds rate by 2019. They lowered it by a quarter of a point to 2.75% is what they call the new neutral rate. So it's amazing. We'll get to what this, the implications of this here in just a moment. But it's amazing that they must be thinking internally in the Fed, boy, if we're raising interest rates at the same time we're shrinking our balance sheet, at some point this is going to have some impact on the economy. And this is now reflected in their long-term projection of where they think the Fed funds rate is going to be. That rate has been coming down consistently over the last couple of years.
Let's move right to the idea then. What does all this mean for the investment markets and then subsequently the economy?
Well, let's begin with the subtle nuance of lowering long-term neutral rate from 3% to 2.75%. Now, that may not seem that much, but this backs up the point that we've been making here on this program that we really, truly live in an extraordinary era in human history. I mean, if you take a look at the last 40 years, we've seen the highest interest rate in human history going back 5,000 years and the lowest interest rate in history, which was recorded last summer. So if you look at a chart of the Fed funds rate, it used to be when the economy was overheating, they would take the Fed funds rate up to 5, 6, 7% if you look at the last several decades. When the economy went into a recession, they would take the Fed funds rate down to 3%. So for almost two decades, we went from 3% to 6%. 3% when they were stimulating the economy, lowering interest rates, 5 and 6% when they were trying to slow down the economy because it was overheating. Now, when the Fed tightened, and you take a look at this history, they're now basically saying that is no longer the normal. And this was broken under Greenspan in the bursting of the tech bubble when Greenspan took the Fed funds rate and shoved it all the way down to 1% and held it there until 2004 when the Fed began to raise interest rates. Then we got into the housing bubble and the financial crisis, and Bernanke took the Fed funds rate down to zero during the financial crisis and kept them there from, 2007 all the way to 2015 when they finally raised the Fed funds rate for the first time from 0.25% to almost 0.5%. So if the ultimate goal is now 2.75%, that is where the bottom of the range has been during recessions in the 90s. The implications, John, to me, are telling us that lower interest rates are here to stay for a lot longer period of time than most people think. Because if we go into another recession, and personally, I don't think they're going to be able to get it up to 2.75% unless we hit, you know, just one series of fiscal stimulus after another, tax cuts, and then maybe infrastructure spending. But if we get into another recession, what are they going to do? They're going to lower the Fed funds rate and another bout of quantitative easing, which means even though they want to shrink their balance sheet now, in the next downturn, they'll be increasing it again.
So I'm guessing the interpretation here then is sooner rather than later we'll be in another recession. And what this enables is the Fed to lower Fed funds rates and then probably some more quantitative easing. Now here's Janet Yellen again.
The committee continues to anticipate that the longer run neutral level of the federal funds rate is likely to remain below levels that prevailed in previous decades. This view is consistent with participants' projections of appropriate monetary policy. The median projection for the federal funds rate is 1.4% at the end of this year, 2.1% at the end of next year, 2.7% at the end of 2019, and 2.9% in 2020.
Yeah, that was the Fed funds rate projection. Now here's a reference to the balance sheet.
The committee announced today that it will begin its balance sheet normalization program in October. This program, which was described in the June addendum to our policy normalization principles and plans, will gradually decrease our reinvestments of proceeds from maturing Treasury securities and principal payments from agency securities. As a result, our balance sheet will decline gradually and predictably. For October through December, the decline in our securities holdings will be capped at $6 billion per month for treasuries and $4 billion per month for agencies. These caps will gradually rise over the course of the following year to maximums of $30 billion per month for treasuries and $20 billion per month for agency securities, and will remain in place through the process of normalizing the size of our balance sheet.
There, once again, Federal Chair Yellen emphasizing that the federal funds rate is likely to be lower than in previous decades, but also that they're proceeding with reducing the balance sheet. So how do they do this? This mechanism always fascinates me, the way this happens. But also, again, as I mentioned earlier, what does this mean for the financial markets?
Well, let's get into the mechanics or get into the weeds. And we're going to have to put this in a little bit perspective to understand how this all came about. So when they began increasing their balance sheet in 2008, they did so by buying bonds or quantitative easing. And they were doing that to shore up money market funds, companies, and banks. And they also continued, and they began also buying mortgage bonds and treasuries, because where was the crisis? Where was the problem? It was in real estate. And what did the Fed want to do? It wanted to shore up the banking system, which had a lot of loans made to the real estate market. How do you do that? You re-stimulate demand for real estate. And how do you do that? You have to bring down interest rates. So they began to continue with these quantitative easing programs, QE1, which was $1.2 trillion, QE2, which was $600 billion, and then QE3, which was supposed to be QE infinity. And in the process, they drove down long-term interest rates in order to stimulate borrowing. And the result is that they now own almost $1.7 trillion of mortgage-backed bonds. That's 29% of the market, and around $2.4 trillion in treasuries, which is about 17% of the marketplace. So the Fed's balance sheet went from around $800 billion before the crisis to where it stands today, which is $4.5 trillion. Now, how did this take place? When they bought those bonds, they bought them by creating money out of thin air. It's not like the Fed has a checkbook or has assets that they can use. They actually don't actually print it. They electronically credit money to bank accounts of bond dealers who sell the Fed the mortgages or treasuries. The Fed gets the securities, and the seller sees their bank accounts increase by the same amount of the bonds that were bought. And so the Fed, in essence, John, isn't really printing money. What they are doing is creating money electronically that wasn't in the financial system before. So that's why they say they basically just create money out of thin air. Now what they're going to be doing is they're going to be throwing this process in reverse. Instead of reinvesting the proceeds, let's say they had, let's just keep the numbers real easy. Let's say they had a $1 million mortgage bond or a $1 million treasury bond come due. What they've been doing up to this time, when that treasury bond came due, they would simply go and buy another $1 million treasury bond or buy another $1 million mortgage bond. They were reinvesting. Now what they're going to do is, when the bond comes due, they simply aren't going to buy it. So in effect, they are going to erase the money that was created out of thin air. They're going to erase it electronically. The money essentially vanishes from the financial system. Voila, just like printing money out of thin air.
Do me a favor, go back through that again one more time on that.
Well, when the Fed was creating money, you know, you hear money printing, we call it quantitative easing, which is just a fancier name. Well, they actually don't print money. It's done electronically. So let's say, John, I'm the Fed, and let's say you're a bond dealer, you're J.P. Morgan Bank. You have holdings of treasury bonds and mortgage bonds, which you're required to own in your portfolio. I go to you and I say, I want to buy $1 million worth of treasuries. You sell those $1 million of treasuries to me, and I credit your bank account with $1 million. Now, where did I get the money? I just created it. I simply created and put money in the financial system that did not exist there. Now what happens is that $1 million bond, which is coming due, instead of taking that money hypothetically and going out and buying another $1 million bond to keep its balance sheet intact, it just vanishes in thin air. So they just let it disappear, just like they created it out of thin air. They let it vanish out of thin air.
And the effect of this on the financial markets?
The net effect of this is the Fed is now withdrawing liquidity from the financial system. One of the reasons why we've seen such a long bull market has been this. I mean, I think the figure was $15, $16 trillion that have been created globally by central banks. So what they're doing now is they are withdrawing money because they're not going to buy those bonds. So now you have a major buyer of mortgage bonds and treasury bonds backing away from the market, which is another form of tightening in addition to raising interest rates. Now, let's talk about the immediate impact is that interest rates have risen. The yield curve is steepened. We'll talk about that now. And we can see this reflected in the 10-year note. If you look at where the 10-year note was at the beginning of September, it was down to close to 2%. It got to a low of 2.05 on September 7th. And as of the day we were doing this recording, it got up to almost 2.3. The 30-year bond went from 2.66, and now it's over 2.8. So the effect on the financial markets is, number one, interest rates are rising. They're going to rise on mortgages. They're going to rise on treasury bonds, which is bad news if you're in a long-term bond fund. This also makes it, however, the one positive thing in the short term, it makes it more favorable for banks to lend money, as the spread between what they pay you, the depositor, and what they charge you, the borrower, begins to widen. In other words, they pay you less money, but they charge you more money to borrow, which means their profit margins begin to expand. And so this also helps banks' profitability. And we've seen the immediate reaction in anticipation of this the last 10 days. You've seen it in an increase in the Fed funds future probability. It went from less than 30%. It is now over 70%. We've seen it in an increase in 10-year treasury notes and 30-year notes. You're seeing it in an increase in mortgage rates. You're seeing it in a breakout in financial stocks and the XLF as financial stocks start to break out, because what the markets are anticipating is the widening spread in interest rates will make it more profitable for banks to lend money.
How long does it take, Jim, with the Fed raising rates and also shrinking the balance sheet? How long does it take before it actually impacts the economy, before it can be felt?
Well, I mean, once again, we have to put this in perspective. The Fed is starting, when they started to raise interest rates, they were starting from zero instead of 1% in 2004, or 3% as they did in the 90s. And they're telling us in this meeting that they're even lowering their long-term projections of interest rates. From 3%, they don't think they lowered it to 2.75%, and that's by the year of 2019. So they still see another 2 years to get to their ultimate goal, which is surprising because at 2.75%, that is where the bottom in Fed funds rates used to be for decades. So initially, as this yield curve steepens, what you're going to see, and we're going to be watching credit conditions, banks will find it more profitable to lend money. So watch bank lending as a sign that that is playing through the financial system as we see the interest rate on treasuries begin to rise, which carries over into a rise in mortgage rates, which carries over into a rise in bank profitability, which is what we're seeing in anticipation with a jump in interest rates this week and also a jump in a breakout of financial stocks. However, given the enormous amounts of debt, and I want to put a caveat here, at the consumer level, the corporate level, and the government level, it will begin to take its toll on the economy. I'm just not sure at what point that is. And the Fed is telling us unlikely to raise levels in the past. So the Fed is basically saying, look, given the leverage in the economy and where we are today, we're unlikely to do what we were able to do in the past. And that was another key thing that came out of this meeting, as they lowered their long-term, what they call their neutral rate, from 3% down to 2.75%. And by the way, that number has been coming down steadily over the last couple of years.
Well, given the history of each Fed rate raising cycle, the indicator that they have when they've done enough is that something breaks. What's the length of time before that all plays out in the economy?
You know, if I had to guess, John, I would say probably in the next 6 to 12 months. So let's say they raise the Fed funds rate in December. So now we're at 1.5% on the Fed funds rate. They begin shrinking their balance sheet beginning next month by $10 billion a month. That's $30 billion by the end of the year. And then we get into the first quarter of next year. They are more likely to raise if the markets are still doing well. Like, let's say we get a melt up into the end of the year like we did last year. They're probably going to raise rates again in January. And also, they increase the amount of Fed balance sheet shrinking by another $10 billion. So I would suspect by the time they get to the second quarter of next year, which is probably, 9 months from now, that we're going to begin to see this impact on the economy. Now, it doesn't sound like a lot right now because they're saying we're starting out slowly. We're going to let our balance sheet shrink by $10 billion a month, which is $6 billion in treasuries and $4 billion in mortgages. And then they're going to increase that. So in Q1, January of next year, they increase that to $20 billion a month. And by the time we get to the second quarter of next year, that's going to be $30 billion a month or $360 billion a year. They're going to be removing a heck of a lot of liquidity. And what that's going to do, there's a couple things that it could do. If they continue to tighten as they do, if interest rates continue to rise as they're doing now and expected to do, that is going to withdraw liquidity. Interest rates are going to go up. That should help the dollar rally. And so collectively, this is going to be a form of tightening. And right now, if you take a look at the press conference, Yellen said not only do they plan on raising interest rates in December, but they're also projecting 3 rate hikes next year in 2018, which would take us to a Fed funds rate of 2.25%, and also 2 additional rate hikes in 2019, which would take us to 2.75%. Personally, I don't think they get that far before they sink the economy. 3 hikes next year plus reducing their balance sheet by $30 billion a month. You know, maybe we'll get lucky. And if we got a major tax reduction, as the plan is going through now, the Senate just passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut. If we got that, and that was followed up next year by fiscal stimulus spending, that might be enough fiscal stimulus to allow them to get away with it. But unless we get both tax cuts or fiscal stimulus, John, I just don't see them getting that far. I just don't see it getting to 2.75% without something happening on the fiscal side.
Yeah, and I think we brought this up last week in the program, too, because unless there is something to counteract the Fed's actions, given the state of the economy, they're not going to be able to go as far as they're announcing or think they're going to go with this.
Well, I mean, That's absolutely true. I mean, if you do nothing else, I mean, this business recovery, this bull market, we're already the second highest bull market in history, the second highest valuation in history with the bull market, and one of the longest economic recoveries in history. So we know what happens when you raise interest rates. It gets more expensive to borrow. We know what happens when the Fed withdraws liquidity in the market. You are taking a buyer, a large buyer, out of the market. What does that mean? One less buyer and a large buyer, that means there are fewer buyers. Somebody else has to step in, or prices are going to rise, meaning interest rates will go up. So given the fact they are proceeding with raising rates, shrinking their balance sheet, and given their record of crashing the airplane, how long before we start to see the impact on the economy and the financial markets before the full impact of tightening begins to weaken really is going to depend a lot in terms of what counters what the Fed is doing. And the only thing that can counter that in the short term and be effective is tax cuts. And it just so happens right now, the Senate just passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut. So if that is passed or agreed upon in the House, the president will likely sign that into law, because next year is an election year, and the last thing that they want is an economy that is in a recession in a election year. So Congress is deeply motivated to preserve their own jobs. But if I had to guess, and there's no way I think they're going to be able to shrink their balance sheet as they're projecting right now. It's roughly about $4.5 trillion. They think that it'll settle down in the $2.3 trillion range or $2.5. I just don't think they're going to be able to shrink their balance sheet by $2 trillion and raise the Fed funds rate another 1.5% from where we are. I just think there's just too much debt out there at all levels within the economy.
We see sufficient strength in the economy in terms of spending, that growth with its ups and downs, but nevertheless is strong enough, looks to be strong enough in the medium term to support ongoing improvement in the labor market. And all of that is good. And I think that the American people should feel the steps we're taking to normalize monetary policy are ones that we feel are well justified given the very substantial progress we've seen in the economy.
That was Chair Yellen's basically saying that the economy is strong enough to proceed with raising interest rates and shrinking the balance sheet. The Fed's comments on inflation were somewhat, a mystery or a little strange?
I recognize, and it's important, that inflation has been running under our 2% objective for a number of years. And that is a concern, particularly if it were to translate into lower inflation expectations. For a number of years, there were very understandable reasons for that shortfall. And they included quite a lot of slack in the labor market, which my judgment would be has largely disappeared. Very large reductions in energy prices and a large appreciation of the dollar that lowered import prices starting in mid-2014. This year, the shortfall of inflation from 2%, when none of those factors is operative, is more of a mystery.
I don't know about you, Jim, but when I hear that, all I can do is flashback to the Jimmy Carter statement. So I've got to find this cut someday online here, that inflation is many and strange, mysterious things interacting in strange and mysterious ways. So here's Fed Chair saying that inflation is a mystery to them.
Yeah, another version of Jimmy Carter, strange and mysterious things. But, you know, one of the problems I think the Fed has is the Fed models are flawed. I mean, we've covered this in last week's show when we talked about inflation, why the Fed was achieving its targets. And there's a number of things that are going on in the economy. Number one is globalization. So companies can move things around where they can produce goods the cheapest. Number two, you've had a major drop in the power of labor unions, which were so prominent in raising wages and wage inflation in the 70s. Number three, you've got multinational corporations that move production, factories, around the globe and around even this country. I mean, here, John, in California, because of rising taxes, we just had Toyota this year move an automobile factory from Los Angeles. I think they moved it to Texas. You also had Nestle move a factory that closed down their last factory and moved it to North Carolina. So you can have companies that can move production facilities anywhere they want, across the country or around the globe. And fourth is technology. I mean, just look what technology is doing in technological innovations. Look how Facebook and social media have changed advertising and hiring. Take a look what Amazon has done to retailing. Take a look what Google has done in communications. I mean, it's just, nevertheless, a lot of this stuff isn't incorporated into their econometric models, but despite all of this, they want to proceed with rate hikes and tightening, so they may end up doing what they traditionally always do, which is crash the airplane.
Yeah, and something that is really interesting is, if we spar off of the President Jimmy Carter comment, a lot of times politicians, you can tell from a lot of testimony in Congress when it goes on, don't seem to understand a lot about monetary policy. And given what the Fed is doing, I'm wondering if President Trump understands what this really means, because this is going to cause that crimp in the economy unless it's countered by something else, such as tax cuts, that has to happen to offset it. And typically, the way the economy is doing is how people vote at the polls. So we have elections in 2018 next year and elections in 2020.
Yeah. And John, there's a good chance we do get tax cuts. I mean, it just cleared the Senate at $1.5 trillion of tax cuts. It's likely to go through the House, in which case the president can sign into law a tax cut, which would impact corporate profits. It would impact the economy. It would impact individuals. So you would have a stimulus to counteract what the Fed's doing on the tightening. And then if they were able to get along on doing this, the next thing I would work on is, let's say, a fiscal stimulus program, which would be easy to get because both parties would like to spend money. It takes a couple of years, so maybe that kicks in 2019. That would be, outside those two events happening, I just don't see the Fed getting to its goal of 2.75% on the Fed funds rate and shrinking their balance sheet by trillions of dollars by the year 2019 without those two events taking place. But right now, the good news is the short-term effects of this is a steepening yield curve, which is going to do a number of things. It's going to stimulate bank lending. That's positive for the economy. And we also have a very high probability now of tax cuts having been cleared the Senate, because Republicans know, as you mentioned, John, next year is an election year. And if they can't repeal Obamacare, they can't even get tax cuts, what are they going to go home and tell their voters? They will be the do-nothing party. So we may have another melt-up into the year-end, but 2018 now becomes a little bit more iffy depending on what happens. But right now, looks like the reflation story is picking up. Financials, energy, and material stocks are flying, so we can now see the reflation trade play out well into the end of the year. But I want to end on this note. Caveat emptor. This tightening cycle, like all tightening cycles that preceded it, will eventually end up bringing this recovery to an end along with this bull market. It's just a question of when this all takes place.
But I should point out, it probably won't tighten and cause any changes in the economy. Before we get back from the break here, as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Given what you said and some of the things that were discussed, as you mentioned, you know, Joshua Rao, the finance professor there at Stanford, said that the overall unfunded liability is around $4 trillion. Were there any key points of contention or areas of debate between those that are managing these public pensions versus those on the other side, like you, for example, who have been pointing out the overall size of this problem and saying that reforms are needed? Are there people that are pushing back saying, well, it's not as big of a problem as you think? Was there any of that at the conference?
Yeah, there was. I mean, there was a lot of that. Most of the finance professors, and I think there was about six of them that were in attendance, all Stanford University finance professors, and they were really unanimous in saying that, you know, the discount rates that these state and local government pension funds use across the country, both to calculate how much they assume they're going to make on their investment portfolios, but also the rate they use to discount their liabilities, are way too high. And so they were very consistent that the rates that are being used of about 7 to 7.5% across the country is unrealistic. And because of that, they're providing a much more rosy picture of these pension funds than it really, truly they deserve. And what the consensus was is that what they should be doing is assuming a rate of return and discounting their liabilities between like 3 to 4% instead of the 7 to 8% numbers that they're currently using. So the problem is, you know, 2 to 3 times bigger than what the governments show on their own disclosure forms than what the problem really is. So the problem is immense. The problem is getting bigger. But because it's becoming bigger, state and local governments are starting to take it more seriously.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you. Since bottoming out in early June, the price of oil has risen from $42 a barrel to over $50 a barrel. Now, many people believe this is due to weather-related events, nominally hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. But what we have to distinguish here and use some discernment, is all of this weather-related, or are the energy fundamentals themselves actually improving? And that's why we're seeing the change as well, whereas the hurricanes may just be a blip en route to some more important issues. So, Jim, you need to tell us whether it's the weather or not.
You know, John, in my opinion, I believe it's the fundamentals for oil are improving. But before we get to that, I want to get to the weather-related events as it impacted the energy sector, because it has been substantial. I'm just going to give you some statistics here, but it just goes to show you how fragile the energy industry is, because people forget about a lot of energy is produced offshore in the Gulf of Mexico. A lot of our refineries are located along the Gulf in Texas and into Louisiana. But just to give you an idea, domestic crude oil production fell by 590,000 barrels a day, or a drop of almost 8%. Now, the end of September, it's expected to get back up to normal. But remember, usually September and October are what we call the shoulder months when it comes to oil. That's the weather improves, the summer driving vacation season is over. So demand for energy is normally less during these 2 months of the year. And then, of course, it starts to pick up with winter heating oil as we get into the late fall and winter months in November and December. Crude oil imports also declined by over 800,000 barrels a day, or roughly by 9%. And one of the reasons is the tankers had to stay out at sea during these storms. They couldn't bring them into these terminals with all the weather as these hurricanes hit. So a lot of imports was also reduced. But the biggest impact that Harvey had was on refineries and petrochemical plants, because you take a look at from Corpus Christi all the way to Lake Charles, Louisiana, crude oil processing by these major refineries dropped by over 3 million barrels a day. In fact, refinery utilization dropped from over close to 97%, dropped to below 80%, because, you know, anybody that was watching that, all that flooding, you got to remember, that's where a lot of our refineries are located, all along the shores there, close to those ports. And this really had an impact, as Dan Steffens and I were talking about in the first hour. You know, if you were on the East Coast in Florida, finished gasoline production dropped by almost 830,000 barrels per day. And so one of the newscasters was talking to, I guess, somebody that did not evacuate in Florida. And they said, hey, one of the reasons we didn't do that is we weren't sure if we got on the road, we would be able to find gasoline. So it just once again shows you how fragile the energy industry is to any kind of weather-related disruptions or natural events, like a couple of years ago when the Canadian oil sands had a major fire and they shut down 1 million barrels of production a day. So anything like a conflict in the Middle East or a terrorist event can impact the energy sector. And more often than not, John, it can be weather-related, because a good portion of energy production is all along the Gulf of Mexico and where a lot of our refineries reside. So the impact of this is going to be that as refineries come back online, they're going to have to step up production to make up for the downturn and the shortages in a period that we normally see refineries kind of wind down. They do changeovers and get ready from gasoline for winter heating oil. And there's some downtime that you normally get during these shoulder months when there's less demand for energy. Well, that's not going to happen this time, because it's going to take to the end of September before these refineries and production gets back up to normal. So that is obviously having some impact on the energy industry. And it's no surprise, as these hurricanes began to hit, you saw the price of oil began to move. So there is a bit of truth to weather-related events having an impact on the energy sector, but there's more than that going on.
Well, given that series of factors, I guess we have to posit the question, why so much pessimism right now? I guess The Economist had an article on the death of the combustion engine. Speculators have been shorting energy. And you know, whenever we deal with these things, we see things go from extreme to extreme. And people were bullish at the beginning of the year on energy. Now the pendulum is seeming to have swung the other way. But if you've noticed, there's always this lag between what the perception is versus the reality.
You see this all the time. It's just a natural tendency of human nature to drive present trends and extrapolate them well into the future. I mean, economists do it all the time. The Fed does it all the time. Wall Street does it all the time. So fear is keeping a dark cloud over the oil sector on fears that, you know, hey, well, yeah, we've had these weather-related events, so therefore oil prices could drop right back down into the low $40 a barrel. But there's so many signs, John, that this is unlikely to happen. And we're going to get into some of these fundamentals now. I mean, outside a global economic event, let's say central banks got really aggressive and began to raise interest rates and the economies of the globe went into a recession. Well, in a recession, we're going to obviously consume less energy. So outside a major recession, either here or globally, I just don't see oil prices slipping back to $40 a barrel, because outside weather-related events, the fundamentals are really supporting oil. And the real key here is there is a lag effect, because a lot of the things that we do and a lot of the reports that we talk about here in the program, whether they're economic reports, Federal Reserve reports, or quite honestly, energy reports, they're based on models. And these models are making projections based on past trends. And as a result of that, whatever the trend was in the last 3 to 6 months, they tend to extrapolate those trends into the future. So the data that we report currently is always lagging in terms of what's actually going on. So markets, when you take a look at it, it's like anything else in economics. Markets, which includes energy, moves on demand and supply estimates. And like many of these government reports, oil production levels and inventory levels are based on government models, and those estimates are often revised with a lag. I mean, how many times? I mean, if you take a look at the GDP figure, we get the initial GDP figure, they revise it, we get a second GDP figure, and finally, when they got complete data in, which is 3 months later, we get the final GDP estimate. It's like that with the employment figures that are adjusted to take into consideration. So all the stuff that the markets react to on a day-to-day basis, whether it's an economic report on GDP or whether it's reporting inventory levels, these are based on models. And models, quite honestly, are basically estimates. One thing that I learned from the late Matt Simmons was that energy reports are estimates based on current trends and are so many times revised. And a good example is the EIA reported energy production for the month of June, which overstated actual energy production by over 200,000 barrels. And then you'll have the markets react, for example, 1 week earlier on in the summer, and they reported that instead of inventories dropping, they actually went up, and that drove down oil prices down for the day 4 or 5%. Those are all estimates. They're based on models. We don't have complete data. You remember, the oil market is probably one of the largest markets in the world, and yet it is the most opaque. And it's one of the things we talked about on the program last week, that OPEC is now changing its emphasis in terms of what it is focusing on. It used to be the markets were focusing on inventories and OPEC's oil production. Well, the real key thing is a lot of OPEC members were cheating because, yes, they were reducing their production, but they were also selling out of existing inventories. So now, as a result of following these markets closely, what is more importantly followed in terms of what OPEC is doing is tanker traffic. In other words, what is their exports? So what we have on a day-to-day basis is markets reacting to short-term estimates, and they ignore the revisions when they're later reported on.
What we have then is that a lot of these reports have been revised. I mean, June was revised by 200,000 barrels. So if we exclude weather from the picture, what else is going on to tell us that prices have actually bottomed?
Well, if you look at globally, world oil distillates have gone from oversupply to actual deficits. In fact, billionaire oil man Harold Hamm just recently gave a talk, and he said that the EIA estimates on a million barrels of increase in production for the U.S. this year is just that. They're estimates, and that production levels have increased in actuality by only half a million barrels a day, so 500,000. So once again, there are a lot of these reports that the markets are reacting to in the short term that are simply estimates that don't relate to reality. And what will eventually happen is at some point the markets are going to wake up and say, oh my goodness, the things that we thought were in existence are true are not actually true, and here's what the actual facts are. And these estimates of production, inventory are always revised to actual results, and that's when I think these markets are going to change, because Bloomberg reported on Friday that global oil refinery outages reached almost 4.6 million barrels a day on this Friday. Now, that's down slightly from 5.4 million barrels a day, but it's still up there as we hit into the late fall, because once again, September and October tend to be soft months. And when we were talking about oil at the beginning of the year or in the summer when it started to rise, one of the questions that we all had at that time, and this was before the hurricanes actually hit, was that, you know, what happens when we get into the shoulder months when people consume less energy because the summer driving season's over and weather improves? Well, that is changed as a result of these hurricanes, because we've had tremendous stoppages in refineries as a result of the hurricane damage, and it's going to take to the end of September for these refineries to get back up online, in which they're going to have to play catch up because they've been shut down for almost a clear month now. The other unrecognized fact is also too, we talked about this last week, that OPEC is now emphasizing, especially Saudi Arabia, shipments of oil. In other words, okay, you guys reduced your production, but are we seeing this actually show up in tanker traffic? It's one of the yardsticks that we watch on a weekly basis, is tanker traffic. Is it increasing, leveling off, or is it decreasing? And it's been decreasing. Bloomberg reported on Friday, in the latest week, OPEC oil shipments have declined to almost 23.8 million barrels a day. That's been descending from over 24 million barrels a day. And the other thing, too, in an unrecognized report, is these drawdowns that we're seeing in oil. Initially, at the beginning of the year, they were estimated to be 1 million barrels a day. It's increased recently to 1.2 million barrels a day. And I'll get to shortly here, it's expected to increase even more as we head into the fourth quarter of the year. So, John, here are just a few factors that we're starting to see here that are corroborating this recent run-up of oil that is not just merely weather-related.
Possibly one of these other factors would be the IEA just revised, what was it, last week, its estimate for oil up, bumped at what, 100,000 barrels?
Yeah, so demand is increasing, and the reason that they're doing that is we are seeing global synchronized economic growth. It's not just that the U.S. economic growth has picked up. It's picked up in Europe. It's picked up in Asia. Japan's economy grew at a rate of almost 4%. What does that mean? As economies grow more, we're consuming more oil. It's not just that. If you look at the things that we measure and look at, other bullish factors, as we're seeing, despite the fact that rigs have increased since the beginning of the year, what we've seen recently is the rig count has begun to flatten. And despite the increase in the rig count, liquid fuel production growth is declining. And one of the reasons it's declining is a lot of our increased production in the U.S. has come from shale plays. A lot of these shale wells, you know, they burn out within 2 to 3 years. You get a fast payback in your first year, and then they go into rapid decline. So a lot of those shale oil wells that were brought on in 2014, 2015, and 2016 are now going into rapid decline. And remember, until recently, when we've seen the price of oil go back up over 50, the rig count in 2015 and 2016 dropped down to like over 350. Now, it's gone up over 100%. But remember, the previous wells that were put in production are now going into steep decline. It's one of the reasons that we're seeing this production growth at a declining level. But the biggest factor overall, not factored into current sentiment and views, is that inventory drawdowns have been massive and are accelerating. They were anticipated to be 1 million. They are now at 1.2 million. And as we head into Q4, they're anticipated to increase between 1.4 and 1.5 million barrels a day. And so a lot of this stuff, the markets have been reacting to lags in these production reports and these inventory reports. And so the drawdowns in inventory, John, are much greater than perceived.
Why don't we put the catalyst for oil together here and show how they're interacting?
Okay, well, I'd say number one, which we've been focusing on all year, is inventories continue to fall, and that pace is accelerating. As I mentioned, from the beginning of the year, 1 million barrels a day. By the fourth quarter, it should be between 1.4 and 1.5. So that's catalyst number one. Number two, the U.S. rig count is flattening and spending on rigs is continuing to fall, which means less rigs producing oil in the future. Number three, as witnessed by the IEA's recent report, as global economic growth is synchronized and increasing, rising global oil demand anticipated to be 1.6 million barrels a day. People forget by next year, oil demand is going to be 100 million barrels a day. Number four, a technical breakout, meaning technically on the charts, oil starts to break out and you can have a massive trigger event of short covering because there's a large short position in oil. And remember, most of that is in the futures market and it's leveraged 10 to 1. So you start having oil breaking out technically and you can have a large short covering take place rather quickly. So number five, you take rising demand, falling supply, falling inventories, all of that is bullish fundamentals for the energy sector.
Obviously, you're seeing it. There must be other people seeing this as well. So the next question, I guess, would be, what other factors do you suppose are inhibiting energy, at least to this point?
I would say a lot of it is psychological, human behavior, and when it comes to investment sentiment. I mean, speculative longs, the lowest they've been in years, so there's a great potential that you could see prices go higher if they cover short positions. But, you know, we covered this last week. Hedge funds have their lowest exposure to the energy sector in years. Secondly, if you look at what's going on with, this explains what we've seen in the energy stocks, retail investors have been exiting the energy sector with heavy selling, and that's been going on since June. And three, speculators are short oil. Now, remember, these guys are short and are leveraged, and they could get hammered here very quickly when you're leveraged 10 to 1 if oil breaks out technically. And then once again, longer term, the position of the dollar's down about 10% since the beginning of the year. And I think two other factors is CapEx spending is down by almost 60%. And I don't care if you're an oil company, whether you're in shale, you're offshore, or a major oil project, you got to replace the oil that you're producing today, which means you're going to have to spend money. And there's no way these big companies, whether it's Exxon, Total, Chevron, or even the mid-tiered companies like Devon and Marathon, are going to spend billions of dollars unless they can be assured, especially on these long-range projects. You start poking holes in the middle of the ocean, you order the oil platforms, John, that's not something that you flip a switch and turn off. So oil companies have to be reassured that the price of oil is stabilized enough before they're going to start spending money. So CapEx spending is down about 60%. That means down the road, that is going to impact oil production. And the other thing is global oil demand keeps growing. You know, in the U.S., we tend to focus on what's happening at Cushing and what's happening here with U.S. inventories. We forget about India and China, nearly half the world's population. Not only have they industrialized, but they're selling more cars. And even though China and India eventually want to go to electric cars, they're still producing. I mean, I own a hybrid car, but when my battery gets down to zero, my car automatically switches over to its gasoline engine. And so we're still going to be driving gasoline engines because we just don't have the raw materials and the battery technology to get us to the point where we're going to be without gasoline. I mean, you're not going to put a 747 in the air on batteries. I just don't see that happening. So when you take a look at it, planes, trains, and automobiles, they're still going to be running on oil.
Well, as you were discussing this with Dan Steffens in Hour 1, how would you break this out for the investment sector?
I mean, I love the energy sector, and I loved it in late July and August when oil stocks were down to close to bottom. I don't care anywhere you looked at the energy sector. If you were looking at ETFs, you were looking at energy mutual funds, you were looking at the big oil companies, the mid-tiered companies. I mean, I was like a kid in a candy store. So I just think there's great values both in the upstream and the downstream sector of the business. And, you know, if you're an income investor, there's still great dividends in the energy sector. You can buy high quality dividend paying oil stocks that are offering you yields twice in what you can get in treasuries today. And personally, I mean, that's what I did myself. I increased my energy holdings in my favorite oil stocks because in this kind of market, when you have the second highest market in stock market history, where are you looking for values? And I've always been oriented more towards value as an investor. And so I still think there's a lot of great opportunities in the energy sector because I still think these fundamental drivers are eventually going to get recognized by the market. When they do, I think the oil sector, energy prices, and the energy stocks could have further to run.
I guess what this means then, Jim, the fundamentals right now you believe are supporting what, higher energy prices, and there's still a ways to go on this whole thing. Speaking of ways to go, what are we looking forward to in shows that are coming?
Well, we're about to enter Q3 earnings season. Q3 is just about to end here. So we're going to have earnings coming up in the next couple of weeks. We're also going to have economic reports. Now, remember, folks, we talked about this. A lot of the economic reports going forward here for the month of September and even for the month of October are going to be distorted by these weather-related events. So I'm not going to put too much credence, and we cover that in the first part of the big picture with even Fed Fed Chair Janet Yellen talking about some of these economic numbers will be a little bit weaker than anticipated because of these weather-related events. So it's probably not going to be till the end of the year that we get some clear economic numbers. But something also to keep an eye on is we have got a tax bill that has moved out of the Senate, and they're also moving on a health care bill. If we get this $1.5 trillion tax cut bill and it makes its way, it's passed the Senate, if the House passes it, you know the president's going to sign it, that could be a big stimulus that moves this market into the final months of the year, and we could actually have a melt up in stocks even given their levity today. So those are the big events. The economic numbers, I'm not paying too much attention to because I think they're going to be distorted. I think the real story is going to be what's coming out of Washington with healthcare and the tax reduction bill, and then also what is going to come out with corporate earnings. What are companies saying about earnings? And I'll tell you, the earnings are going to be fabulous for the energy sector, as we just covered it. And that's one of the things that happened in Q1 and Q2, as Dan Steffens and I talked about it. But, you know, people on Wall Street, they're still bearish. Well, watch those energy earnings coming out of Q3. So corporate earnings and Washington are the main things looking forward to the end of the year. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.